Right. And so right at the beginning here, let's go ahead and talk just a moment about these three books that we've been looking at. What is it that brings these three books together, First Timothy, Second Timothy, and Titus, and makes them books that we would study as a unit? Why would we put those together? All right, yep. All right, the denominational world would call them pastoral epistles. They would say they're written to pastors, but they're written to young evangelists is what they're written to. And so that makes them somewhat unique, right? You know, most of the letters that we have would be from Paul would be written to congregations or groups of congregations. The only other letter written to an individual from Paul is that one, Philemon, and its subject matter is different entirely. And it would actually be grouped in with the prison epistles. But here, so the subject matter is going to be similar. All right, so that's what brings them together, the recipient. But then, because the recipient has that connection, the themes also have a connection. Like Colossians and Ephesians, we call those sister epistles because they have so many similar things to say. Well, the same thing would be true of these books. And so what connections would we make between these books? What are some themes that you see, you know, kind of across the board, or at least in a couple of the books? All right, certainly qualifications. In both cases, Paul is concerned about conveying the qualifications of elders and deacons and having Timothy and Titus pass those instructions on, and therefore the appointment of those men in those congregations that they're at. What other themes might we see? All right. So in both cases, we have instructions on an individual level. You conduct yourself this way. And in both cases, what is one of the primary reasons that we need to be, you know, evangelist needs to be concerned about that? All right. Yeah. Because of the effect it will have on the message, in other words. Right. So you leave the door open for criticism, not only personally, but the criticism then affects the message that you're presenting to. As much as we might say, and that's something that as you look at that emphasis, as much as we might say you separate the message from the messenger, Paul says, practically speaking, they're going to be connected. They're going to be connected in people's eyes. And so you have to take that into account when you're the evangelist, that people are going to look at you and the message as connected. All right. What are some other similar teachings that we... What about relationships where you see the similar things being spoken of? Relationships to other people. And men and women, how women... What men are supposed to be doing. I want the women to do this. And so, yes, he sort of divides those groups up in both places. And as an individual evangelist, this is how you approach these different groups, and these are the things you need to be watchful for as you approach these different relationships that you're going to have. There's one thing that just comes up to me repeatedly through you know, the letters, all three letters, and it's to stay away from something. What does Paul just warn over and over again, in one way or another, to stay away from? We're going to look at it again in this last part of chapter 3 here. Yeah. Worthless. Yeah, just silly things that maybe either don't matter or don't have an answer, or maybe are just false. But in so many ways, he starts out 1 Timothy that way. He would warn at the first chapter of Titus. He's warning right here at the end of Titus over and over. Stay away from these things. That hits really home with me, because I think sometimes we find maybe a Bible class that devolves into foolishness. We see that a little bit harmless. Doesn't look like Paul sees it as harmless, does it? That is problematic. That is, you know, it's a cause for division that ought not be there. And so as an evangelist, particularly, you be careful not to go down that path. Don't you, you know, allow that in maybe your preaching and teaching. You stay on course. You stay true to these things. And so that's a very prominent theme, we might say, is, you know, stay on track, pay attention to what you're teaching. Any other thoughts before we move on into chapter 3 as far as some of the connections and themes that we've seen? Right. Yeah, and you might say that goes along with, but in addition to the stay away from these things, it's you hold firm to this, and maybe the most emphatic statement of that is in chapter 4 of 2 Timothy. But all along, there are statements of hold true, even tonight again, as we begin this last few verses of Titus 3. He starts with, this is a trustworthy statement. How many times have we said through the course of this, where Paul is beginning what he's about to say, what he's about to say with either, you know, God is my witness, a witness between us. This is a trustworthy saying. Some emphasis that says you pay good attention to what I'm about to tell you and you hold on to this and you don't let it go. And so that's, again, will be the case this evening. Any other thoughts there? All right. All right, well, let's pick up here in Titus 3 and verse 8, and we'll go through, we'll read through the end of the chapter, and then we'll come back and make some observations. This is a trustworthy statement. And concerning these things, I want you to speak confidently, so that those who have believed God will be careful to engage in good deeds. These things are good and profitable for men. But avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and strife and disputes about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. Reject the factious man after the first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. When I send Artemis or Tychicus to you, make every effort to come to me at Nicopolis, for I have decided to spend the winter there. Diligently help Zenas, the lawyer, and Apollos on their way so that nothing is lacking for them. Our people must also learn to engage in good deeds to meet pressing needs so that they will not be unfruitful. All who are with me greet you. Greet those who love us in the faith. Grace be with you all. All right. Now, again, there is the trustworthy statements concerning these things. I want you to speak confidently. Going back through Timothy and now on to Titus. There's language here about which that Paul uses when he's conveying a message. And what is that word that we keep repeating when Paul sort of emphasizes here and he talks about you being able to speak with confidence? Why can Titus or Timothy speak with confidence from the words of Paul? What do Paul's words have? They have authority. All right. And over, you know, when Paul uses that kind of language, you know, you might just note that, you know, make a note out to the side or whatever. Just note that Paul puts his words. I don't know how many times I've said this through this study. Paul puts his words on the level of God's words. I mean, that's and so there's not one little lowering, not one bit of lowering of importance from words that are in red in your Bibles, maybe, and Paul's words. They all carry the weight of God's inspiration. And so, and that's the way that Paul talks about his words. All right. So he puts that importance on it, this trustworthy statement. He puts that authority with it. And he says that this is a trustworthy statement and you have confidence. And for to what end is this statement and this confidence? To what goal? Right? And so that, yeah, so that the people who believe God will be careful to engage in good deeds. All right, so you speak these things and you speak, you speak with confidence and you speak with boldness so that those who have believed God will be careful to engage in good deeds. These things are good and profitable for men. Now, what is the trustworthy statement then? All right, very good. And what has come before? What have we talked about? All right. He starts, all right, back at the beginning of this paragraph, or the paragraph preceding, he starts right at the beginning there with remind them of this. Subject to rulers, authorities, obedient, ready for every good deed. That's all right. That's the starting of that conversation. Because And stay away from these things. All right. Stay away from maligning and rather be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration. We ourselves were these things and we've been there, but we've been moved away. We've been taken out of those things and transferred over here. All right. What I want to suggest to you is this is a very similar argument to Romans chapter 6. All right. Romans chapter 6 says, you know, we don't behave that way anymore. Why? Why don't we behave that way anymore? What event should signal that we don't behave that way anymore? Yeah, we've been buried with Christ in baptism. So we don't behave that way anymore. All right, so we've changed. We're different people. We've been brought out of that, and that's the motivation here. Look, we were like that, but we don't behave like that. And you tie this back to what he says about those who are in Crete. All right, they particularly were like this, but they're not like that anymore. And you remind them that that's what they used to be, but that's not what they are anymore. Now, that transformation from the old to the new. The fact that they're having to still be reminded suggests what? All right. It's not magical, right? It's not a matter of you are baptized, the Holy Spirit's transformed you and put a new heart in there, separate and apart from your own actions and your own free will. And so you don't sin anymore. It doesn't even tempt you anymore. You're not tempted by sin. You're a totally different person, magically changed. Outside of any instruction. Now, if that were the case, then the instruction would no longer be necessary, would it? And so those reminders, when Paul says in Romans chapter 6, you've been transformed, he's reminding people of what they agreed to. Not what magically happened. You don't have to remind people if they've been transformed without their, you know, own volition. But if it's my choice, then I can forget I made the choice, can I? And I can start to slip back. And so somebody says, hey, don't you remember what you agreed to? And I think that's what this sort of thing is don't you remember that you're not that person? You agreed not to be that person. You agreed to put on Christ. You agreed to put to death all of those things. And the blood of Christ made that possible. And so don't forget what you signed up for. And don't forget what kind of persons you ought to be. This is very different. I say very different. This is different, and it needs to be said that it is different from what some people in the religious world would say about, you know, good works. And even some of our brothers and sisters of Christ are kind of picking up this mantra that good works are not something we do in order to be saved, but it's something we only do because we're saved. And they'll turn to a passage like this and say, see, he says, here's your motivation. And because you have been changed, then you do good works. Yes. All right. I understand that. What happens if you don't do the good works? What's the situation of those who do forget and who do go back? Right. The reminder is not, it's not simply like the pleading mother who comes up to the child and says, oh, we don't do that. You know, no, he's saying we don't do that. And if we do, then we're not Christians anymore. You know, we have surrendered. We have abandoned our calling and we've gone back to what we once were. And so he's telling these people, don't go back. Don't go back to what you once were. You've been called out of that for good works. And if you're not participating in these good works, what does it mean about what happened? It means obviously didn't mean as much as we thought it did. I mean, that's what it, you know, that's the appeal to the baptism there. That's the appeal here to the grace and being made heirs together. Don't forget what you've done. You can certainly lose that hope of glory. And we could bring in numbers of passages, and especially in the book of Galatians, for instance, to talk about all those who have fallen away, and Hebrews as well repeatedly warns against that. So it's not just saying you're already saved. And doesn't that make you want to do good? No, it's saying you're saved and don't forget it. Because if you do, you could be lost. And so we do need that reminder, not just merely as motivation for something we can't lose anyway, but rather a motivation to remember that we can lose it. So remind them to engage in good deeds. Right. And that's, you know, a lot of times in foreign work, you find that to be the case. People, oh, they respond. They respond to this hope and this calling and this election, and they want to be better than they are. And then they go back home and nobody else is doing it. And it's not long before the sacrifices start coming up, and they're not ready for that. And so they respond much more enthusiastically than we're used to seeing people here. And yet that enthusiasm wears off so quickly. And I think that's quite that need to be reminded, because now I think we all need that reminder, but there may be a particular need in the face of that. Any other thoughts on that? That whole notion of the need for reminders and why we need to be reminded. All right. He says that this is good and profitable, and then so remind them of this so that this will be the case. But on the other hand, avoid these things. Yet again, avoid these things. And it's already been stated in this book to avoid controversies and genealogies and strife and disputes about the law. Again, I would I want to make sure we have a qualifier. Are the controversies that need to be addressed? Paul seems to engage in a lot of controversy, doesn't he? You know, for someone telling other people, don't engage in foolish controversy over and over and over again. And yet so many times we find him standing before crowds and saying things that are very controversial, ending up with him in prison or beaten or any number of other punishments that he endures as a result of the controversy he engages in, or the apostles and the controversy they engage in. So we have to be very careful that we don't just label controversy as foolish because it's controversy. It's not, you know, even division, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, that must occur. They're going to happen, and they must happen, and there must be a separation from time to time. We have to draw lines of distinction. However, what sort of things qualify as foolish? What makes a controversy foolish? Right. At one time, it would have been of great importance what family you were from in the Jewish nation, right? What makes it of so much less importance in Christ? The law is done away with, and so many aspects of their intermarriage, you know, I mean, they had to be careful about keeping tribal lineages and inheritances, and now none of it matters, does it? It doesn't matter if you don't marry a Jew anymore, right? I mean, before that was problematic. Now it doesn't matter. And so if the genealogies, as much as I enjoy, you know, a good family history, if we forgot it all, it would be okay. And it certainly doesn't need to be something we fight over. All right. So if it doesn't matter, if at the end of the day, even if there is a correct answer, even if we dug far enough, at the end of the day, if we get the answer, we say, here it is. Here's the right answer. All right. Are we any better for it? Then let's not argue. Let's not go too far down that rabbit trail if the right answer really doesn't mean anything to us spiritually. And it didn't. And it wasn't a matter of it couldn't be found out. It was just a matter. It didn't matter. And it shouldn't have mattered. All right. But that's not the only thing that might make it foolish. It might not matter. But then there's some that are foolish for other reasons. Or maybe additional reasons. What are some foolish controversies that might be brought up, that why they might be foolish as we're discussing something in a Bible class? Well, I think that gets on down into the factious man. There's people who like to argue. Brother David? Right. Okay. So a lot of times hypothetical situations, and we try to come up with the most convoluted sort of a scenario. And I'm not saying all hypotheticals are absurd. I mean, sometimes there's value to asking a question like that. But we can get so far in arguing a hypothetical that we lose sight of the reality. I think another thing, and this one is something that I think happens a lot. Go ahead, Trevor. Okay. All right. So that's where I was headed, is basically the answer is not there. It's not a matter of even we could find it if we worked hard enough. It's just not there. I had a friend I was talking to the other day that said they were about to start a whole quarter of classes on angels. Wow, 13 lessons on angels. What's gonna be the topic after the first class? And he talked about all this, you know, these directions they were going in. And he said, really, there's a lot of literature. And I was like, yes, there is. Not a lot here, but yes, there's a lot of literature. And so I can just imagine how that class is going to go, to tread into territory that's not revealed and to try to come up with explanations. Well, it seems to me, you know, and then it becomes an arguing over something about which there is not an answer that's available to us. Jay. Right. Well, I would say on that one, that at least we, you know, that there is foolishness that goes along with arguing for that. But I would say that disputing against that would not be foolish in that particular case. But there are places where people will argue, for instance, about, you know, how long Adam and Eve were in the garden, how many years and things like. And you're just, what are you talking about? You know, why does it even matter? And then if it does matter, or you can come up with some reason why you think it matters, clearly we're not going to get the answer. And so all of those things are reasons why we just need to examine and say, okay, maybe I do have an opinion about this. But that opinion is not worth arguing over. And it's certainly not worth spending any tremendous amount of time on. And again, I point out that Paul over and over and over says, avoid these things. Watch out for these things. If a division occurs, like Paul says, they must occur. Well, I tell you what, I better be able to say that it was worthwhile. And I better be able to say because it was standing on some firm principle and not because I was simply couldn't keep my mouth shut over something that didn't matter. Disputes about the law. Now, that one gets interesting because people want to bring that one in and say, see, you know, we have disagreements over what the law says. What kind of disputes about the law do you think might be under consideration here? All right. All right. I think particularly that. All right. Disputes about who needs to be circumcised and should we still keep these feast days and so forth. And what seems to be the tenor of the New Testament is, look, if you want to keep being circumcised, that's fine. We're not going to get into an argument about it, though. And you're not going to force that on anybody else. And I think that would be the dispute. It's not a matter of going to the old law and one person thinks it says one thing and another person thinks it says another, but rather it's the person arguing for whether or not that should still be applied. And I think the dispute would be, the reason that there could even be a dispute is that there's clear indications that people could continue to keep the traditions and that God was not against the traditions going on, provided they were not relied upon for salvation, and provided that they certainly were not imposed upon anyone else. There, that imposition is probably the biggest dispute that would come up about the law. All right, so that's the notion there as far as disputes about the law. I think it has to be, really. All right, with regards to all this, he says, unprofitable, worthless. Now, the man who will not listen, who will not heed warnings, who continues to press his point even after we've determined that this is meaningless, this is pointless, what do you do with him? And what does that mean? I think the rejection here, it's obviously, it's not saying you get into fisticuffs here, right? And it's not saying, I think, you physically do something here, but rather the only rejection from a spiritual standpoint that we can find in scriptures would be what? Yeah, so withdraw from this man. That's the notion here. And what is the notion, or what is the idea that you get from the first and second warning? Is that a detailed layout of, you know, you get two chances, and what is it? What's the notion there between one and two warnings? Right, you make an effort, make another effort. I think that the first and second warning here is no more rock solid than how many times you need to forgive someone. And as you look at various places, Paul seems to indicate in other places, I didn't even give them one warning. You know, I didn't yield for even an hour. But, you know, with certain false teachers, it's going to vary from one person to the next as to how we're dealing. Is this person very factious? Is this person just ongoing factious? But you warn them again, and then you do something about it. You don't just let it go on and on and on. But neither do you just turn against someone without making some efforts, making a concerted effort. And so I think that both of those indications are there, that the need for action, but also the need for making the effort. What does it say about this man that maybe to us seems a little bit strong in language? How does it describe him in verse 11? That's pretty stiff, isn't it? And again, I would say, you go to these kinds of arguments that we hear in Bible classes, and we roll our eyes, and we wonder when that guy is going to just get over it and move on, and why we don't ever do anything about that man. I was at a place where we had a man like that, and it took another guy coming and visiting with us, and he wanted to place membership. We didn't have elders. And he said, I would like to be here. I like the people here. But if y'all don't do something about that man, I cannot come here. And it sort of woke us up. And we were like, yeah, I mean, we kind of gotten used to it, kind of numb to the factiousness, to how argumentative, and we treaded lightly, and we just sort of try to stay out of his way and try not to get him riled up. And then we realized, no, this man is a problem. And we addressed it. And we confronted him about it, and he apologized. And so there was our first warning. He went right back to it the next Bible class. We confronted it again. He got angry and he left. And we, you know, that was not our desired effect. But I'll tell you what, the congregation was so much better for it. So much better for saying, we cannot keep going like this. People were afraid to get up and teach Bible class. They didn't want to be attacked, and people are afraid to comment in Bible class, afraid of that, you know, contention that would result. It's poison. It's poison to a group. And I saw firsthand why Paul would say, avoid, avoid, avoid. And if someone is bent on that, he is perverted and he is sinning, and you do something about it. And I mean, that's strong language, and it's something that we need to keep in mind for ourselves, and even when we see that in our midst. All right. His final words, he mentions several people here, and we won't take time to go into all of those, but we've heard several of these mentioned before. Particularly, I would just note Apollos. Here, and he says, diligently help Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way so that nothing is lacking for them. It's interesting. This is, again, nearer the end of Paul's life, certainly long after his interaction with Apollos and Apollos' disciples, you might say, there in chapter 18, 19 of Acts. He brings up Apollos' name. Paul brings up Apollos' name in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And what is the nature of him bringing up Apollos' name in 1 Corinthians 1. Okay, some are saying I'm of Apollos. And versus I'm of Paul or I'm of Peter. And I think it's good to note that while Paul saw those people engaging in that, he never engaged in it himself, did he? He didn't take sides, and he didn't look and say, I mean, there's no jealousy there. And he would say in 1 Corinthians, I planted, Apollos watered, God gave the increase, And we see that attitude continuing here as he's concerned about, you help these other fellow workers of mine. Maybe there would be a tendency in some to go, well, Paulus is getting a lot of attention. No, you help him. He's a worker in God's kingdom as well. And so there's never any tone of jealousy among Paul. The only time Paul is ever concerned about attention towards him is when people are taking it away from him and giving it to false teachers. Now, yes, he's concerned about that, but he's not concerned about people giving attention to other preachers of the truth. So here he encourages Titus to help Timothy. Again, he brings up the good deeds people must also learn to engage in good deeds to meet pressing needs so that they will not be unfruitful. Again, go back to what was said about the Cretans. What is one particular characteristic of the Cretans that would be addressed here? Lazy. All right. Engage in good deeds so that they will not be unfruitful. That's laziness, right? You need to get these people up and doing. And I think there again, we need to be engaged in not just preaching against what people should stay away from, but preach what people ought to engage in instead of that. Paul would, in several places, Colossians especially, would talk about what you put off and then what you put on. All right, so don't be lazy. What do you do? All right, well, engage in good deeds. And so supply something for what they're trying to put off. Like in so many of his letters, he greets not only from himself, but all who are with Paul. And it's interesting to me, I can just imagine the longing among Christians in that day. There would be such a feeling of camaraderie across such great distances. Make sure Timothy hears greetings from us as well. Greet those who love us in the faith, he tells Titus. And then finally, grace be with you all. And I would just reiterate my comments from 2 Timothy and 1 Timothy as you close out, where Paul says at the beginning, grace and peace be with you or to you. And then at the end, he generally concludes with grace be with you. And so it's sort of bookends the letters that Paul would write. Any other comments about any of that before we close this evening? All right, well, we're looking forward to starting the history and geography class on Sunday morning. If you have not gotten a book, please do so. Or if there are any that are needed to be ordered, then let one of the men know. And we will be laying that groundwork, that foundation of history and geography on which all of this is written, to put those places and times in our minds. Appreciate everybody's good attention this quarter.